Welcome to The Sustainable Life. This is Josh Spodek, and I'm here with Sven Gerlinger. Sven, how are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. Excited to be with you today.
I'm really excited to hear, too. I have to say, I've only been in this building with you, I don't know, 5 minutes?
Yeah.
10 minutes? And the teamwork that I'm seeing and the attitude, it's amazing. And so you're the chief experience officer of Northwell Health.
Yeah.
Living in Manhattan as I do, I see it all over the place. And I think my primary care physician is in Northwell.
That's great to hear.
And, oh, I forgot. When we spoke before, I mentioned my colonoscopy experience,
yeah.
Which I've been putting off because I'm in my 50s, but there was a pandemic. And it turns out that I had a really high fiber diet, which meant that I had to come back later because I didn't empty so well.
Yeah.
And talking to you about that, did I influence you on your situation?
You did. So, you know, I believe we're the same age. So I actually am. I've been putting it off too. So I am in the process of scheduling it now myself. So,
okay.
And now I know what to do about my diet because I have a high fiber diet too.
Yeah, we're going to talk about food. That's what brought me here is this tremendous Washington Post article about what you have done on food. Now, food is, I believe, one aspect of being of what you do.
Correct.
And I'd like to get to, I think I'd like to do a deep dive in food. I suspect other stuff may come up that's also worth deep diving into. But maybe we could start with what is a CXO? Because I think not a lot of, I didn't know about it. How long has it been around? What drew you to it? And, you know, how did you get into this?
Yeah. So, well, you know, chief CXO, chief experience officers in healthcare are still, I would say, a relatively new concept. It started about 15 years ago or so, the Cleveland Clinic. I met the first formal chief experience officer title as part of the C-suite. And I think that's the key part here, so that patient experience is at the same level as our focus on finance, a focus on quality and safety and all those important metrics and things that focus that hospitals and healthcare organizations are focused on. And with the, you know, it was started with the idea of improving patient experiences because for a long time, forever, healthcare organizations have not paid attention to that. It was a very provider-centric model, more patriarchal model where, you know, the healthcare provider, the physician, you know, told the patient what to do and they followed. And then over time, the patients developed more of a voice, and it was not just the medical care itself that's important, that it's important how we're treated, how we are made to feel, and the environment in which we practice medicine. And so all those things are important to patients. And it started, it's about two or three decades ago now, when a company started to do patient satisfaction surveys,
mm-hmm.
and where that voice of the patient really came out. And then about 15 years ago, the federal government and HHS started to compensate hospitals also partially on the experience of patients and on quality aspect of it, the outcomes and patient safety components, as well as the opinions of patients and how they perceive their care to be. And that was a game changer, because all of a sudden now there was a financial incentive as well. And I said now that brought the CXOs to the table, and it wasn't just a nice thing to do anymore.
It feels to me, and tell me if this analogy works, that doctors, they take care of you. The bedside manner is as important, or, I mean, I don't, maybe not, shouldn't compare them, but it's critically important. And a doctor with the terrible bedside manner is going to have some serious problems really helping a patient. And is this like the bedside manner, like bedside manners to doctor as chief experience officer work is to the hospital system?
It's all connected. And I think it is, you know, bedside manner is what we used to talk about, that it's important for doctors to have good bedside manner. I think it's more fundamental like that now it's part of in how they really practice medicine. that in how they communicate with patients, which is getting to the part of where they're building a relationship with the patient, and in what they say and how they say it, and is part of the treatment of that patient. It's not just being friendly and say hello and doing the nice things. And there's lots of evidence that support that. Then we even have a training for physicians. It's called the Relationship-Centered Communication Program, when physicians go a whole day through a program where we teach them skills and how to navigate that encounter and how to build that relationship, how to reflect on what the patient has said and how to collaborate in coming up with a treatment plan together and not just say, here's what you have, this is what it is, and this is what I'm going to tell you what you need to do. So that they're both equal partners in that journey.
And going back to you, are you more administrator, more doctor? You went to medical school and both?
No, not at all. So I'm administrator, and I kind of, I don't know, fell into it is the right word to say it. I have no medical background. Until 16 years ago, I've never worked in a hospital before, and I had a career in the hospitality industry for almost 20 years. So I started in hotels. I actually started in, we'll talk about that later, I started in kitchens. I'm a trained chef back in Germany, went to hotel management school to get a bachelor's degree in hotel management, then came to the U.S., with the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. So I was working in luxury hotels in management for a while. And Ritz-Carlton was almost like a decade. And I worked for other hotels as well. And then I fell into healthcare, and I was approached to actually, when I was living in Michigan at the time, in Detroit, and a big health system there called Henry Ford Health was opening a brand new hospital, and they wanted it to feel like a hotel. They wanted it to be a hotel for sick people, and they were looking for hotel expertise to come in and to change the traditional model. And I was approached by the CEO there to join. And at first, because I didn't have a background in healthcare, I didn't see that possibility. I didn't think that I should be doing that. But then I remembered that I had a very significant healthcare experience at that point, about 6 years before that, where I was paralyzed from head to toe, and I was hospitalized for 3 months with a disease called Guillain-Barré syndrome, which came on very suddenly. And I was out of work for about a year. Almost a year. And I learned the hospital system or the healthcare system from the patient's perspective the hard way. But I learned a lot, and I learned how incredibly special the field is of healthcare, and how incredibly special the people are that work in it. Mm-hmm. And then I put two and two together that I can actually marry my professional experience as a hotel executive with my personal experience as a patient, and hopefully be part of the system to improve the experience through my expertise and my experience.
I'm it's going to be hard not to ask you about the experience of being paralyzed from head to toe, but there are many things that you said that I want to follow up on, and I'm going to table that one in case we can get back to it, if you're open to talking about it.
Of course. I talk about it all the time.
Okay.
I talk about it too. Our new employees every Monday, I share my own patient experience and tie it to why their roles are important, and that they are the ones that provide a positive experience. So, but we can get into that.
What's really intriguing to me, what's really fascinating to me is changing culture and changing oneself. Personal leadership and leading systemic change. It sounds like you are in some ways brought into a systemic change going on throughout American healthcare. You then yourself had to change yourself personally. And now I see you, this article By the way, if people want to pause this conversation and go and read the Washington Post article, I'll put the link in the notes, and it's worth reading it because the Washington Post has a pretty solid reputation.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, is this a paid advertisement? But I know it's not because the Washington Post doesn't do that. And so people want to pause this and read that and then come back. Oh, as you were going to say.
It was the food writer of the Washington Post that came and spent 2 days with us.
So it feels to me like there was a cultural change going on nationwide driven by the federal government and patient voice coming up. And then you got swept up in it. But now you're not just going along with change. You're changing things a lot. And for someone who's my goal is to change culture around sustainability, which I believe that a lot of people have this dichotomy in their minds, which does not exist, of personal action versus systemic change. And they think if you're doing one, then you are not doing the other. But systemic change begins with personal change.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I wonder if, so did you relish? I mean, systemic change is hard. Changing culture is really hard.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, I guess, a good place to start. When you got into here or the Ford place, did you know how big changes you were going to take on? Did you have a vision at the beginning? What was your emotional state before? Were you scared? Were you enthusiastic?
I was probably both. I mean, there's a level of, I wouldn't say scared, but you know, there's a level of anxiety that comes with that. I started in healthcare. Never worked a day in healthcare, as I said, and I've opened a new hospital. I started a year before the opening. I was responsible for roughly 400 people, 400 people that were under me, 15 different departments, and we were in the phase of putting this whole thing together. So that brings anxiety to, you know, obviously not wanting to mess up and to be ultimately have a very successful opening of that place. So I'm a big believer in using the experience that you have or what you've learned in the past and surrounding yourself with great people that have knowledge that you may not have and that balance you in the deficiencies that you bring as a leader, and to not micromanage them, but to paint a vision and to, as a team lead, to work towards that. And so when I came in, there was also, I would say, a healthy dose of naivete in that benefited me.
You're naivete. Not knowing the...
Yeah, because I think that shielded me from some of the preconceived notions of things like that, how we've always done it, the things that have always existed. So to come in with this different mindset and this different lens of hospitality and to put this to healthcare, I surrounded myself with a nurse mentor who taught me everything about nursing and what I need to be careful of and what motivates nurses and how do they... Where the landmines, same with physicians especially. So the chief medical officer of the hospital was always had my back and was kind of protecting me, because that you can easily step into landmines, and I have some examples of that. And so that's how I learned the healthcare, and I still benefit from that today. And I think I'm a pretty quick learner in terms of learning by osmosis and being able to navigate the landscape. But it was very fast paced because of the speed of the getting a hospital open, because I did that for hotels, but in hotels you have very different complexities or less complexity, because in the hospital you have all the regulatory issues that you don't have to worry about. For everything from how does a hospital get paid, all the way to the getting ready for regulatory visits and making sure that everything is checked and double checked and triple checked, and to prevent, you know, patient harm and all those things. And that's where naivete came in. I think that's where I didn't know what I didn't know, that I would be responsible for that. And so you just learn quickly on your feet.
You mentioned people, and I mean, I think of medicine as a pretty, I mean, most people have to be very well educated to do what they do, and there could be a lot of friction. There could be a lot of pushback, and especially to someone coming in from outside. And that's very relevant in sustainability, because people who are wanting to be more sustainable and wanting to change organizations, those organizations generally, they're looking to make a profit, often doing something that pollutes. And so someone coming in and suggesting, you'll like it more if you change, they'll think there's a lot of, we know better. Thanks, but no thanks. And yeah. I could easily see people pushing back at you or giving a lot of trouble. How did you get the nurse on your side? How did you get the CMO with you? Or was that set up by the CEO before?
That was part of it. I think you have what I call air support from the CEO, where, I mean, they hired me for a reason, because I wanted to have a different place. I wanted to be not just have another great hospital, that I wanted to have a hospital that can change healthcare. And that's eventually, essentially what we achieved. So when we opened the doors to the hospital, we were in the 99th percentile for patient satisfaction. I couldn't believe the report we got. We thought it was a mistake, actually, in those Prescani surveys. And so all the things that we've put in place, but starting with the people, you know, hiring the right people, setting them up for success, training them, investing in an enormous amount in them, and then how the little touches we put in, and how the physical environment was very different from other hospitals. That all came together. But certainly there was pushback. And again, I think having mentors to talk through that and to help, even step in and say, hey, here's where you have to be careful, you know, because this could turn off physicians very easily. And either through things that I was taught and told, or what I learned myself. And then you just don't make the same mistake again, and you move on. And now, having been in healthcare for 16 years, I'm almost thinking that I have to remind myself that I am an outsider, that to be the insider, that I'm an outsider for a reason. Even in my role now, you know, one of the reasons why Michael Dowling, our CEO, hired me was because of my hospitality background. I mean, and especially having worked for Ritz-Carlton, because he's a big believer in bringing outside perspective into an organization to change fundamentally, and not just have incremental change.
So yeah, coming here on the elevator, coming up here, you mentioned this Lenox Hill is 100 something years old.
Yeah, it's 170 some years old.
So that's very, very much older than something that just opened.
Yeah.
Here, there's going to be a bureaucracy. There might be more pushback. There might be different landmines. Was that the case here? But you were also brought in here, and you had a track record.
So I've, you know, when I joined Northwell, we had about, I think, 17 hospitals that were half the size of what we are today. But today we have 21 hospitals. But hospitals is not just the only thing that makes Northwell. It's we have 60% of our business, if you will, is ambulatory practices, so physician offices, ambulatory care, all the care that happens outside of the four walls of a hospital. And that's where we really have grown tremendously. So it's not just changing culture and the experience in a hospital, but it's also in the ambulatory network and encounters, which, again, we have many more of. And coming here, Lenox Hill was at that point where I think we've had it for 3 or 4 years is when Northwell acquired it. And it was a failing hospital. that's why we acquired it. And there was had bad quality scores. The finances was at the brink of bankruptcy. Patient experience, I think, was in the 10th percentile. And employee engagement, morale was very low when we took this over. And So there was already like three, four years ahead of me that the organization has worked on rebuilding or building the foundation. And then I came in, but we were still in the, I think, in the 10th percentile, like the patient satisfaction. Today, we're at the 70th and continuously making progress. We have the highest physician ratings here on the inpatient side at Lenox Hill. And it is building blocks that you have to put in place, put the right leadership in. You know, we have patient experience leaders at every one of the hospitals, and to make sure that the right person is leading the effort here, collaborating and working with the medical leadership, the nurse leadership, and the other administrators in the building. HR is a big component in changing culture, hiring the right people, holding people accountable for inappropriate behavior. And that takes blocking and tackling. That takes every time somebody steps out of line and is behaving in a way that's contrary to our culture, then that has to be addressed. And that in some cases leads to finding work elsewhere for some people because they're just not a good culture fit anymore. Bringing the right people in, making sure that the ones that are here are on board, helping the others that are not on board find employment elsewhere, and making sure that everybody understands that we're serious about moving in that direction. And our quality scores have improved dramatically here. The hospital's doing financially really well. And it all ties together. Our morale has improved dramatically, especially employee morale and engagement and patient customer satisfaction are very well linked. So that's why I work very closely with the HR leaders as well.
Were you the incoming CXO, or I mean, was that position
that was
here
the first
before?
One. Yeah.
So they brought you in for a new position.
So Michael Dowling created the role, and then I was fortunate. So they did a national search, and I was fortunate to be selected to be the CXO.
And perhaps they were fortunate to have you to a mutual. And before you started, I presume that for a C-suite position, I presume you're going to meet all the other members of the C-suite and the people that you're going to work with. How did you screen here? How did you make sure that the fit was? And also, how did you create I presume that you came in with a vision that you crafted with other members of the C-suite. Dowling must have had some idea that you must have worked to make sure it would fit with you. And so you didn't just come in here like, and then they give you a notebook and say, like, here's how to get started and here's where your spot is going to be.
Nothing.
So how long was the process of from when they contacted you to you started? And
that was 6 months. So from first contact, getting a call from a headhunter to, it was at the end of September, and I started on April 7th. So actually in a month and a week, I'll have my 10-year anniversary. Mm-hmm. So it's a big milestone. I mean, Michael Dowling, his mantra is to create excellence with whatever we, in wherever we practice and whatever we do, just to be the best. And so that was the marching order, and bring the right expertise to do that. I had, best practices, things that have worked in the past, again, from at that point, 6 years of hotel, of my healthcare experience, and then my hotel experience. But I'm a big believer in seeking first to understand before to be understood.
Uh-huh.
One of the 7 habits of Stephen Covey. Mm-hmm. And that's what I asked Michael Dowling when I came. I said, just give me a couple of months, please, just to get to know the organization. And I want to go everywhere. I want to sit in waiting rooms, and I want to walk the buildings and meet with the leaders and understand what they're proud of, what were the accomplishments of the past, and where are they today, and where do they want to go, and what's holding them back from where they want to go. And so I spent most of my time in my car driving to Manhattan, Staten Island, out east, Suffolk County. I sat in waiting rooms in personal clothes, jeans, polo shirt, and just observed and listened, and to get like a current state in where we are, where we need to go. And then started to create a plan and put a team together, put a strategy together, created an executive steering committee that was chaired by Michael Dowling and myself. And the relevant key C-suite leaders at the table, I called them, that was my board, to start to make progress. And we then started a year later, we started with building as a patient-centric culture, and we call it the culture of care. And then we had a big unveiling, if you will. We brought all of our leaders together. There was 4,000 at the time, so everybody who was a supervisor and above rented the theater at Madison Square Garden on a Saturday morning, asked everybody to come in on a Saturday, or it was more like five or six hours, very inspirational, motivational, and we talked about one thing, and that was improving patient experience. And that was the burning platform, right? The why behind it, and how we're gonna move forward, and that this is really, really important for us. And that was the kickoff. And then we built training programs and started with the leaders, with the executive leaders, did workshops with them, and not really focusing on the scores or where we were, more focusing on what we called reigniting the passion for healthcare. I started with the executives, would ask the executives, why did you go into healthcare? What motivates you? How do you work together as a team? How are we going to make patient experience important? How will you lead that? Because the rest of the organization in your building and your area of expertise are looking to you to lead the way there. And then it trickled down to the next level of leadership. And then we had a patient experience class for Paul, at that point, 50,000 employees, that took us the better part of a year to get to an in-person class with every single individual on how they fit in and what their role is. And that was very interactive, very hands-on, to really penetrate the entire organization.
Very comprehensive, it sounds, and very thought out. So it took you months and months to think it through. And it sounds like even after you thought it through, there was talking to lots of people to make, I'm sure it changed and evolved as you spoke to people.
Yep.
Then to make it happen, you had to have an implementation plan,
yep,
which it sounds like step one was the C-suite team to get alignment. Then, well, it was 4,000 people at Madison Square Garden. So that was huge. That sounds like a really big, I mean, not just a big step. Yeah.
Yeah.
And deliberate, like it wasn't
deliberate. Correct.
This hadn't been done before. It wasn't like here's a standard operating procedure. We just do this thing. And Madison Square Garden, I presume. I mean, it's a business. You can just go and get the space there, but it's not.
It's not the big arena.
Yeah, down
theater.
Yeah,
and the hall's about 5,000 people, so we almost filled that whole thing. And we've brought in some external speakers also. Like, again, very motivational, very inspirational.
Had this organization done things like that before? I'm guessing that these other leaders are like, I'm guessing that they're looking around the room feeling like, is this really happening?
Yeah.
What's this? But, so how did you say it was a
rally? We called it a rally.
It also sounds like a pivot point that like just before and after. What is it? Is there a before and after?
There was one before.
I mean, sorry. I don't mean were there events like that before. Did this mark a change in the culture of this organization?
People still talk about it today. Mm-hmm. Still say, I remember when we kicked this off at Madison Square Garden and how they felt about it. And to me, I still remember that key moment was either a day or 2 days after I'm in my office, and the head of our Feinstein Research Institute. So the Research Institute for North Local Health, Dr. Kevin Tracy, he's an incredible researcher, and he is came into my office, almost stormed in and said, that was amazing. I really believe now we can do this. We can change the culture and change our trajectory moving forward in terms of patient experience. And for somebody like him to be so excited about that was really special. And that there was an affirmation of that I think we're doing the right thing and we're on the right path.
Okay. To say something like that is special and an affirmation, I think is understating. How did you feel? Can you name some emotions that you felt? That
extraordinarily, I was blown away. I was like shocked almost that because at that point also, I mean, he's a wonderful guy. He's super, super nice guy, but he's like what we call he's the father of electronic medicine, and he is a world-renowned and revered researcher. So you have this extraordinary level of respect, and especially for him to come in to do that, that was overwhelming. And yeah, that was an incredible feeling.
All right, now he's going to be someone prestige status.
Yep.
How about a run-of-the-mill patient? I mean, you've been talking about the reports that Proskauer gets.
Yeah.
You must also get direct, I mean, you must be face-to-face with patients sometimes too.
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell a story?
Well, most of it is done through, letters we receive, feedback we receive. We also often document those patient experiences, and we actually ask patients to come in and we videotape them, and then bring also the person that made the big difference for them, like the physician, the nurse, the therapist, whoever it is. And whenever we get those letters, especially the letters, it's very gratifying to see that you made a difference in somebody's life. And there's a difference also then to think back at my previous job in the previous industry in hotels, where we also received feedback about great experience people had. But when you read it in healthcare, you saved somebody's life, and the nurse and the physician, everybody had so much empathy, and they went above and beyond to take care of them and their family. And then inevitably a tear runs down your cheek. And I can't remember a time when we actually cried over a letter in the hospitality industry. And I often use that example when somebody asks me to compare and contrast hotels to hospitals. The stakes are much higher, and it matters so much more to give somebody a dignified, empathic experience when they're going through something often that's massive and life-changing.
And in business school, we did a case study of Ritz-Carlton and how much they put into the care and attention to with the guests. And I heard you in a different podcast say that the teamwork here, you had never experienced anything like the teamwork here. And I thought, I remember what I read about Ritz-Carlton. I haven't been on the team there, but if you're qualitatively on a different level here than you were there, that's amazing.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what I said, but
it was during the pandemic.
Yes, I've never seen anything like that. It was just mind-boggling that people worked nearly 24/7. To save people's lives, and the commitment that was displayed at every level, at every part of the organization. I remember on a Sunday afternoon being on the phone with our procurement person, the senior vice president for procurement, who was in charge of purchasing, because she was working around the clock getting supplies and making sure that we don't run out of supplies for our staff members or when we were talking about policies around providing patients with tablet devices so that we can, when the hospitals were shut down because of COVID, people couldn't come in. So we needed to give them the ability to stay connected to their family members, especially in situations when it was the end of life often. And that was tragic.
And also huge unknowns. Who knew what direction the virus would go?
Yeah. And we did things in a matter of hours and days. It would have taken us months and years before. And it was just incredible to watch that with a single focus, an entire organization working together. And again, didn't matter what level you were. Executive directors, so that's what we call our CEOs, that were clinicians jumping in and working the COVID floors. Our executive director at South Shore University Hospital, who's a nurse, it's being in the room with patients, holding their hands in the full COVID outfit in the gowns, and providing end-of-life support to somebody. It is just incredible to watch that and to be part of that. So yes, there was a level that I could have never imagined anywhere else. The level of dedication, commitment, professionalism was spectacular.
I speculate here that I think of, I'll do an analogy with an artist. Because I've been, here's a great story. Did you see the movie Girl with the Pearl Earring?
I did not.
Okay, there's a, so it's a made up backstory of how Vermeer's painting Girl with the Pearl Earring happened. And Scarlett Johansson plays this woman who's, I think, a maid in Vermeer's house in 15 whatever. And no one's allowed on the floor of their small building, of this family's building, which is Vermeer's studio, because it's where he works and he's Vermeer. But she's allowed into dust and things. And he says, you're not allowed to touch anything here. You can just dust it. So she's in there by herself. At one point, there's a scene, there's a still life that he's painting. And she doesn't touch anything in the still life, but she looks at the painting, which is half done. He's not there. She like looks under the canvas over the, not the canvas painting yet. And she sees what it looks like. And the camera shows what it looks like. She moves something, not in the scene, but off camera, like not in the scene. And then she goes about her business. And the next day she comes back after he's been painting. And she looks in the painting, even though what she moved was off the scene, it reflected the light a little bit differently. And it's different. The painting is different because his attention to detail is so there. Every stroke matters. No stroke is wasted. Everything is. And this to me is something that comes with virtuosity, mastery of a craft.
Yeah.
And I think that when a crisis situation, you know, in movies, not Girl with the Pearl Earring, but like Tommy Lee Jones, there's like the comes in a scene, he's like, okay, you do this and you do that, and you do this and you do that. I don't think if it does happen like that, it can only happen from them having worked so closely with so much attention to detail, like that Vermeer thing. And I speculate that things coming together when the crisis hit, that must have been a lot of tight working together, a lot of attention to detail, a lot of one-to-one communication with people beforehand. Am I right?
You are. I think it's attention to detail and the investments that we've made in our culture really came to fruition there. Because I think that gave oxygen to that teamwork, and where people put away the titles and the red tape and all the things that may have existed before to work together as a team to get to that level of perfection, and with just one goal, and that is to help the next person that's in front of you.
Now, was the preparation for that? Did that also include some arguments and fighting and misunderstandings and feeling like, Jesus, I don't have to deal with that level of detail. But then in the moment,
passion for helping people. You know, to the point where I remember talking about the devices where we were deciding which devices were better than others, and you know, it goes through a review of data security and things like that, and it turned out that Samsung tablets were better than, I hope this is not going to be a problem, than Apple devices because you can wipe them better with the information. But there was a family driving down from upstate New York where their family member was in the process of dying, and they probably were not going to make it in time to see them because we allowed visitors when they were in end-of-life situations. And the only thing they had was an iPhone in their car. So we made exceptions, and we made sure that we got them the Apple device so that they could do a FaceTime call versus with the other system that we had set up. And, you know, exceptions like that were made all the time because in the spirit of humanity and making sure that we do the right thing for people.
Now, I'm going to switch topics abruptly.
Yeah.
Because I want to get to the Spodek method, even though I want to get to food, but hopefully we'll get to that at some point.
Yeah.
So I work on sustainability leadership, which is distinct from sustainability. Sustainability is about facts and numbers and parts per million and things like that. Leadership is about people and culture and changing culture. And so you're someone who's played a leading role in changing culture. And also, I'm also swayed because at NYU, there's a professor, not a medical professor, who she did a study of a whole bunch of things, but one of them was a UK hospital and an Indian hospital in India. And the same procedure, it was an eye care procedure. The Indian hospital produced 5% the waste. I forget if it was waste or CO2 equivalent to the UK one, with better outcome. And I know that my experience with American healthcare, there's a lot of waste. And I don't know if that's in the purview of CXO or not, because it doesn't seem necessarily a patient experience, but it's something driving me to learn more about this industry because, you know, it's not like the auto industry, speaking of Ford. It's not like fashion, which is way up there too. It's not like travel. But I have heard people speculate, is it possible that with all the waste that the net effect of healthcare is negative? I have no idea the numbers, so I don't know. But if it's 1/20th the amount for this one procedure, it feels like there's a lot that could be done. So this is something motivating me to this industry. Is environment something that matters to you? You know, enough that you've done something in your life to do something about it?
Absolutely. I think I'm very passionate about the environment, and it's pretty shocking to see, and actually coming from the outside, it was shocking to me to see the amount of waste that is produced in a hospital. Mm. Just the amount of, I think about the latex gloves that they can get consumed every time person comes in, puts the gloves on, touches a patient, takes them off, throws them in the trash, moves on, and it goes to the next one. The amount of hand sanitizer, the chemicals. And I don't just feel or think about the chemicals that are being used, the trash that's being used, but also the impact on upon the humans. And that's not good for you to ingest that into your hands all the time. But the challenge is that it balances with patient safety and with keeping infections down. You know, that's what hospitals are focused on, you know, to prevent harm. So it is done in the spirit of doing good, so that every time you can prevent somebody from having an infection, then you can save people from dying, even in the most extreme cases. That's why it's done. That's why everything is individually wrapped. That's why, in the ORs are huge waste producers as well. And we have a lot of initiatives going on across our health system to reduce that waste. It's not my area of responsibility. I'm connected to that through the work around food and, you know, how we can reduce waste there. There's lots of opportunity for that, but it pales into comparison of what the waste that's generated in a medical facility.
Now, separate from this organization or this industry, in your personal experience, nature and the environment means different things to different people, especially if they've grown up in, you know, if someone who grows up in the mountain is different than if they grow up on the ocean. When you think of the environment, are there any, can you think of a quintessential, maybe formative moment for you when you are in nature? And that, like, one thing I think of a lot is if I ask you to paint a picture of nature, what comes to mind?
Bring it back to my childhood. So I grew up in Germany. I grew up in the foothills of the Alps and in Bavaria on a farm that's about a mile and a half outside of a village of 3,000 people, and about an hour and a half outside of Munich, close to the Austrian border, very rural Germany. And the farm goes back to 1333, that it's in my family's possession, actually. That's when it was first mentioned in documents. And my dad inherited it, and then was turned part of the barn connection into a restaurant. That's when I was 6 years old. That's where I developed my love for hospitality. That's when I literally started working when I was that young, and maybe I was 10. I started helping out. But as a child, I was roaming the fields. I would go out in the morning, and non-school days, and I would come back at sunset and would run through the forests and pick up things and gather things. It was always with animals or connected to nature, and always dirty from head to toe. My mom has stories to tell about that. So I have a deep connection to the outdoors and to just the earth. And then being right on the edge of the Alps, we spent a lot of time in the mountains, and there's just no other place, I think, where I feel that the air is so clean and where it's so, it's just a different feeling to be in that environment. But as a kid and as a teenager in particular, growing up in a rural area, you want to get out of that. You want to go to you see the world and the big city. And so I didn't appreciate it as much as I appreciate it now. So now as somebody who's over 50 years old going home, and I try to go home, but once or twice a year. My mom still lives and my brother lives in Germany, and I'm a runner now, and to run in the area that I was spending time as a kid, and as I said, roaming around, is just it's a wonderful feeling, and it feels just very invigorating. To do that now, I appreciate it even so much more.
I'm guessing the air of Manhattan and Detroit probably makes the clean air there even more special.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah,
not special because that's normal. This is abnormal.
Yeah.
I don't like to think of this as normal and that's like special.
That was certainly normal to me as a child.
Are there any specific memories that come to mind? I mean, it could be just a time going through the woods on the way home from school.
Yeah, I think the memories of just collecting things and building things out of natural materials. I was always these micro places from moss and rocks and twigs, and I was always fascinated with that, and that was my playtime. And also, I guess that's my biggest memory, or that's what I did with friends. After school, friend come over and we just run and find things to play with, literally in the fields and and there were little. There's a creek running through there, just jumping the creek and being able to do that. There's not many places in the U.S. where you can do that because things are polluted. Mm-hmm. And it was just, those are, I think general memories that I have of being connected to nature.
And I think you lived at a time to be deprived of Instagram. You could have been on the cell phone if you'd been around then.
Exactly. Well, video games.
Yeah.
It was just the start of video games, actually. Atari was, we did play a little bit of that.
And so you're in the creek, you're with the friends or by yourself and with these, what's the sensory, what is it just, what do you see, smell, taste, touch, hear? You can bring us there.
It's earth and clean air, but also, it's the countryside, so you have also agricultural smells. If you take a break, they just knock on the door.
I can't tell if they knocked on this door or a different door.
I think it might be a different door. So, yeah, it's, I'm just trying to think about what I don't know, it's hard to describe what it feels.
When you said earth, it hit me at once. smell of earth.
Yes.
The feel of it, yeah, like my hands going in the dirt, the sound, I couldn't help but hear, like, it's the sound of nature that sounds like silence, even though it can be noisy, like wind or birds. That's what hit me when you said that, because of the way you said it.
Yes. It's the sound of water, like the sound of the creek. Yeah, the feeling of digging your hands into dirt and the texture of that. And that's what, it sounds weird, but that's what we played with and built on the creek. And it was like mud also and rocks, but we built stuff out of the mud and built, I guess, call them teepees or something, like a tree house, but on the ground against the tree. And that was our house that we built and protected. And then a storm came through and tore it all down.
How about the emotions? Can you put a name to some of the emotions you felt?
Joy. I felt free, liberated. I mean, it was brief. There never care in the world to when I was out running around.
So joy, liberation, to say freedom, not a care in the world.
Yeah.
Here's the challenge. If you're up for it, I invite you to think of something you could do in your regular life here that creates those emotions, that brings those about. Not exactly. We're not trying to replicate. Only that situation is that situation. But to create for yourself some joy, some freedom, some liberation, without having to be a kid in the Alps. And if you're up for it, three constraints that have come through experience is something you're not already doing, something that you do yourself. So you got all these people here, and it's tempting to say, oh, I'll start some program here. But it's for you yourself to get this experience. And now the goal is to create this feeling that you've had in nature before. It's not to fix the world, but there is a constraint that whatever you do has to leave the world. You have to leave it better than you found it. You don't have to measure it, but it has to leave it better than you found it in some way. Want to give it a shot?
Yeah, the challenge about that, it's not already something that I'm doing. This is throwing me off, because I do love spending time outdoors, gardening, growing vegetables, things like that you know, I didn't do for many years. But connected to that, you know, especially if I think about making the world a better place and thinking about where I live now. I don't live in Manhattan, but I live just north of in Westchester. I think often about, you know, how to teach people that are in, you know, situations that they may not have a connection to that, or that have the especially food insecure populations and et cetera, and, to help them to grow things. Like, you know, there's an organization here in New York called Harlem Grown. You're familiar with it.
Yeah, we talked about it before recording.
What Tony Hillary has done, and to inspire kids in this urban setting to grow things, grow vegetables, and make the connection to health by getting them to get engaged in that, I think is fabulous, in vacant lots in Harlem. So, you know, doing something like that or volunteering there is actually something that's on my mind to do, that would give me that sense of satisfaction to be connected to the earth, to the soil, and especially then to give back and to leave the world a better place. Right? Because I also think about sometimes an experience I had when I was back actually in Germany. He's still the first person who I really got to know was from America. She was from Staten Island.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working with her in a hotel in Germany, in Hamburg. And she grew up in Manhattan, then moved to Staten Island. And we had a conversation about food, and we talked about strawberries. And I was completely shocked that she didn't know how strawberries were grown. She didn't know that. You got them at the market or you picked them up in the grocery store. So you didn't know that they grow on the ground, on the vine. They're not. They could have grown on trees. They could have grown however, and she would not have known. And that was, I felt so sad for her. She came from a pretty well-off family. It's not that they didn't have resources, but she didn't know.
Yeah. Oh, man. Tony Hillary at Harlan Crown has, have you heard the story about the chard? So he started Harlan Crown during the recession of 2008-2009.
Yeah.
And he started working with the school there. And he petitioned the city to use that vacant lot and cleaned it all out and the flower and the planting beds. And so he brought some kids out and he said, okay, here's some chard seeds. And they all dug a hole and they put the chard seed in the hole and they covered it up. And the kids go, where's the chard? And it's like, well, it takes time to grow.
And no, so I did not hear that story.
After some time, the chard grows and he gives it to the kids to take home because they don't charge for anything.
Yeah.
And so when the kids come back, he says, how was it? And they go, our moms threw it away. And he's like, what? And there have been enough generations of not ever knowing what chard is that they had no idea what to do with it, so they didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
And talk about culture change. And, of course, there's plenty of doof around. We've talked doof,
right? About doof,
Oh, now I'm really curious if doof... Okay, I got to get back to... You said it would be very satisfying. Now, in the forest, you talked about joy and liberation and freedom.
Yeah.
Would it also have that?
Yes, I think so. And I think it's mostly because of the freeing, being free to help others and to get them to experience what maybe in a small sense, in a small way of what I experienced, and to teach exactly that food doesn't grow. Something doesn't grow just overnight or as soon as you put it in, that there's a process that goes with that.
So let's make it a SMART goal. I presume you know the acronym.
Yes. Specific, measurable, actionable, relatable, and timed.
Yeah.
Relevant.
I would say time bound.
Okay.
Because I'd love to record a second conversation with you and find out how it went. So what would specifically you do? And how many times over how long would you have to do it that if we scheduled a second conversation, if I asked how it went, you'd have a meaningful answer of how things went? If this is not imposing too much.
No, it's not, I guess. I mean, the timing is good because we're in almost March now, so we're entering the growing season. So maybe 3 months.
Okay. And so I guess you would, what would you do? I mean, I guess you have to contact them and find out, can I volunteer, and then find some...
Yes, I would have to find out how to get started. But I know that Ida has these volunteer opportunities to get people to work with the kids and to help them grow things.
Okay. And so after we finish recording, would it be okay to get out the calendars and then schedule a call for after that or conversation?
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to say something with you that I don't usually do this. But when it's someone in New York, and Harlan Crown, I've been meaning to volunteer there too.
we'll do it together.
Yeah. I saw the guy that I did it with. He was, when I talked about this challenge, he was a beach person. He really loved beaches. And one thing led to another, and it was easier than going to a beach. It was going to Lower Manhattan, not far from where I live. There was free kayaking. And he went to kayak, and so I'm kayaking with this guy, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was really great. And Harlan Crown, I know people who read my blog know that I volunteer. I do these workshops up at Drew Gardens, which is it's in the Bronx, and it's this place where there was a wreck, and 10 or 15 years ago, some people came through and took out all the garbage and cleaned it up, and now it is, to me, it's possibly Central Park and Drew Gardens are like the pinnacles of New York City. And amazing. But Central Park is this huge corporate thing now. And Drew Gardens is so community. And I go to do these cooking workshops out there. I bring my pressure cooker and my battery because I'm off the grid.
Yeah.
And they give me food from that garden. The best tasting butternut squash I've ever had in my life is from there. Anyway, so I would love to, if we can combine forces, I'd love to.
That would be great. I would love that. Let's sync up.
All right.
Let's do that.
So I want to ask a whole bunch of other questions. We're over an hour. And how about I guess we could pick up where we left off the next time, because I want to talk about the food.
Yeah.
Which I can see them bringing the food in.
Now we get to taste it.
Yeah. So people have gone and read the article and come and listen to us. They know what the food is like. And I said, when we record this, can we do the food? And you're like, yeah, we can. One last question, though. This commitment to volunteer. I walked you through this process. Yeah. And I asked you these questions. Are you doing this for me?
No. I think that it's an additional motivation and a trigger maybe, but it's been on my mind, especially that, you know, my daughter, my youngest daughter, 4 kids, she's volunteering at a soup kitchen every Friday after school, you know, where most kids do go right off and do other things, and to see the satisfaction that it gives her. Because she packs bags, hundreds of them, up to 1,000 or something like that, with a few other kids, and then get distributed the next day. And so my daughter is setting the example, and it's been on my mind to say, I got to do something too. And I have, like you, so much respect for the Harlem Broad organization. It's just like a perfect fit. So glad you asked that question. And you motivated me to do that.
Now, you having the leadership experience you have, you're probably picking up on what was going on. And I mean, especially because you were earlier talking about like what motivates people, what their passions are.
Yeah.
And starting there, then getting the action, as opposed to Bangladesh is going to be underwater if we don't all...
Right.
Very different, right?
Yeah.
So I want to talk to you later about your impression after you do the volunteering, or we,
yeah,
and how this fits with our conceptions of how to act on the environment, how to lead cultural change, especially from someone who's done it.
Yeah.
So I think we'll have to put that on the agenda for next time.
Let's do that.
Although, is there anything I didn't think to ask or something to close with?
I mean, let's have a food conversation next time, because we can do that in just a minute or two.
Oh, yes.
So that's something I'm very, very passionate about, and I'm really, really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too, and Sven Gerlinger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
How many people are bringing a message of joy from what everyone calls saving the environment, but I call the future? Step by step, this podcast is creating a culture of joy, community, and connection around sharing and acting on our environmental values. Again, there's no profit in buying and wasting less, but we'll all love our lives and relationships more when we do. I can use your support. Please donate at joshuaspodek.com/donate. Again, that's joshuaspodek.com/donate.